this everyday observation, he says, that are just as dark about human nature as any real tear open your guts and show all the horrible sides of yourself comedy. As proof, he cites Seinfeld's bit about refusing to dispose of your trash at movie theaters. There is an agreed-upon deal between us and the movie theater people, whoever the hell they are, and that deal is understood by every single person in this room. The deal is, you're ripping us off. Okay, we get it. We're fine with it. Lots of overpriced, oversized crap we shouldn't be eating to begin with. In exchange for that, when I'm done with something, I open my hand. Mulaney goes on, that line, I open my hand, and the way he says it, that's as dark and shitty as we are as human beings. No, you clean it up. That is as dark as saying, I left my wife and kids 'cause I'm God. We all relate to the feeling of, no, I'm not throwing that away. Mulaney's right. The bit has a lot going on beneath the surface. It speaks to our selfishness, our laziness, our childlike craving for fairness and revenge. It speaks to the ease with which we dehumanize others and the system that makes it even easier by forcing us into transactional relationships. After all, it's the theater company that rips us off, that sells us the overpriced, oversized crap we shouldn't be eating to begin with. We get even by leaving our popcorn buckets behind, but it's not the company that cleans our trash. It's the minimum wage employee who works two jobs just to keep her kids in school. But that doesn't stop us, does it? Do I think Seinfeld arrived at this bit from a desire to probe the dark heart of human nature, or because he wanted to examine the transactional essence of relationships in late capitalist society? No. I think he got irritated when the movie theater people asked him to pick up after himself, then realized it's funny that most moviegoers don't think twice about leaving their trash behind, that we've all tacitly agreed it's okay to do that. Seinfeld sees a world of tacit agreements, and his hair trigger crankiness prompts him to question them all. As Will Durant said, we are what we repeatedly do. And what we do the most are the trivial things, the things we don't think twice about, the things our nature prompts us to do, the things society gives us tacit permission to do. The totality of Seinfeld's material, all of it composed with a poet's ear for rhythm and brevity, paints a picture of humanity that's as true as those confessional comics, because the tedium of our lives defines us as much as our deepest fears and yearnings do. Seinfeld sees us and judges us for our absurdity. He sees society and judges it for the same. But none of his judgments is that harsh. We could be better people, yes. We could pick up our trash after the movie. We could quit duping innocent people out of hard-won earnings. We could stop buying so much useless garbage in waiting. We could exercise a little self-restraint at the buffet. We could find a better religion than wallpaper. We could fight for a system that prioritizes people over profits and real relationships over transactional ones. We could, and we do. The man who lost control at the buffet organized a protest. The woman who left her popcorn bucket in the theater aisle opened her wallet for a cause. The mother who obsessed over wallpaper patterns raised her son with love and pride. We can always be better, but the undertow of the modern world is strong. We are constantly being dragged back into its absurdities and hypocrisies. Seinfeld, who is both critic of and apologist for humanity, doesn't want to condemn us for our mistakes and weaknesses. Plenty of others are happy to do that. Seinfeld just wants to make fun of us. On Friendship. The body misleads. It's discreet, separate. Its edges are well-defined. Every second of your life, the distinction between my body and not my body is reinforced. You see the book in your hands and know that you are not this object. Tight as you hold it, the paper will not become a part of your body. You hug your friend. You look at her and think, she is there, I am here. You say goodbye, and your bodies go separate ways, each its own whole. Situated in a body with its clear-cut boundaries, your mind imagines it is equally distinct. It imagines its edges are as well-defined as those of the body it controls, that it can easily tell where I ends and not I begins. That when friends part, their identities part too and go separate ways. The sensory experience of the body teaches us to think of ourselves as individuals, as discrete entities interacting with other discrete entities in the world. Individuality is an intuitive concept, and being intuitive, it's also politically persuasive. This is why individualism, the social theory that prizes the moral worth of individuals, is at the heart of liberal society. As the great philosopher of liberalism, John Stuart Mill, said in 1859, over himself, over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign. Societies organized around this principle protect individual rights, expand individual freedoms. Their legal systems rely on individual responsibility. They value self-reliance, promote personal choice, independence. The body trains us to think of ourselves as individuals from within. Society teaches the same from without and misleads. I don't want to argue with John Stuart Mill. I'm not here to say that individuality is a bogus concept. We all have a sense of self, and that sense is valid and necessary to live. It guides our actions, determines our ambitions and habits. There's no perfect answer to the question, who am I? But we all make an attempt. We throw whatever we can into the stew of self-concept. Likes, dislikes, memories, hopes and fears, skills, job, gender, ethnicity, race, nationality, temperament, physical traits, top 10 movies, favorite sports teams, how we think others view us, how we view others, how we think others view how we view others, romantic desires, work ethic, where we fit in our network of relationships. And from these ingredients emerges a unique identity, our individuality, which evolves with age and every new experience. I don't wonder about the existence of individuality. I wonder about its boundaries, its edges. Are they as sharp as the bodies? Are we as discrete as society leads us to believe? Is there a bright, solid line between two people, two identities, two partners, two friends? For a long time, I've had a feeling that there isn't, that identity, who I am, is more porous and shared than we commonly presume. Maybe my body isn't the outer limit of myself. I first had this thought in Boston at college. Elsewhere in this book, I describe what an intellectually formative time that was for me, but it was also emotionally formative. If I felt detached from my education in high school, as I explain in my essay on Emerson, I also felt somewhat detached from other people. That might sound odd to those who knew me then, but it's true. School felt to me like a social gauntlet. I wanted to be liked, but more than that, I wanted not to be disliked. Like millions of kids, I feared being the one who's teased, laughed at, avoided. Because I had a last name like Pushak, Poo, then Shack, enterprising jerks had a head start, so I had to build defenses fast. My chosen shield, the one that proved the most useful, was comedy. Nothing diffuses like a joke, as all class clowns know. Nothing deflects the laser beam of ridicule like a laugh. Making someone laugh is the quickest way to get them to like you. And when you're a kid, it doesn't take much. You don't have to be Seinfeld. You don't need polished bits. Silly voices, writing something childish on the blackboard, a pratfall, recycling a movie quote. Any of these will do the trick. All class clowns are hacks, but they know how to get a laugh. My school years were joyful, but when you're always playing the social game, the popularity game, you tend to keep others at a distance. The distance might not be that great, but it's enough to prevent a deeper connection. That's because trying to be cool is a defensive posture. You don't let people all the way in because that's what makes you vulnerable. The blasé attitude that's a signature of so many cool teenagers is just emotional armor. In high school, I followed a maxim best articulated by Michael Douglas in the abysmal 2009 romantic comedy Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. The power of a relationship lies with whoever cares less. Like the insecure and handsome Matthew McConaughey, I had to outgrow this immature philosophy if I ever wanted a loving relationship with my childhood sweetheart, Jennifer Garner, or anyone else. I'm still outgrowing it. Learning to lower your defenses, learning how to love and be loved, is a life's work. For me, that work began on a shitty morning in 2008. I woke with one of those hangovers that feels fine until you stand up out of bed and the room spins like a teacup's ride that's come loose from its tracks. In 20 minutes, I had a meeting on the far side of campus with an academic advisor to discuss my application for a study abroad program in New Zealand. I ate as many frosted flakes as my stomach could handle, 7, drank some water, and journeyed out into a Boston so cold my back muscles seized. From my earliest days at BU, I had dreamed of traveling to New Zealand, where the school had an internship program in partnership with the University of Auckland. Now that the semester was finally approaching, I was giddy. I'd been talking about it for months, researching New Zealand, reading about internships, watching The Lord of the Rings on repeat. Has there ever been a better tourism ad? I arrived at the advisor's office with a minute to spare, managed a crooked smile through the apocalyptic headache, and was promptly informed that I failed to take a course required for my major and so did not qualify for any study abroad programs, before vomiting onto his desk. Okay, I added the last part for dramatic effect. I get it. Woe is me. This is microscopic on the scale of actual problems. And what's worse, it was my fault. But it was a hinge point for me. One of those times when your life goes in an unexpected direction. The next semester arrived, my two closest friends left for their own study abroad programs, and I remained in town, feeling lonely, attending a profoundly boring class I should have completed a year prior. But as is often the case with shitty life moments, it turned out to be a gift in retrospect, and I owe that to new friends. That semester, I fell in with a group of people who had until then been only acquaintances, faces I'd seen in corridors at parties. It's funny to think back on it now, after more than a decade of close friendship, after all the experiences, the late nights, after living through our 20s together, figuring out our careers, after attending and one time officiating at their weddings, after holding their children. It's funny to think about those first hangs, how nervous I was, how determined not to show it. Back in freshman year, I relied on old habits to make friends, jokes and buffoonery. With this new group, I did the same but toned it down a bit, because I was toned down. I was 20 then, questioning my interests, values, identity. I was vulnerable and ready to lean into that feeling for the first time. I don't know if they could sense that in me. Maybe it was obvious, but they were generous all the same. And that, of course, is the key. I say, of course, but generosity is a tough lesson to learn when you prioritize being liked. Worse than defensive, it's selfish. Your chief concern is your own feelings, while friends become a means to insecure ends. Self-absorption corrodes friendship. It corrodes all other relationships too, but friendship is the laboratory where most of us discover that for the first time. Family ties are imbalanced by nature, but they can survive all kinds of crap because the members are stuck with one another, in most cases. Romantic relationships usually occur later in life than friendships and draw from the lessons learned or not learned in them. If you can't maintain a healthy friendship, there's little chance you'll make a romantic partnership work. To quote the famous line, "Friends are the family you choose." They can also choose to walk away, much easier than family can, if the relationship ceases to be rewarding. To have good friends, you have to be a good friend. You have to be selfless and caring and generous. All the corny things McConaughey learns in the third act of Ghosts of Girlfriends Past. And if you can take these things to heart before your mid to late 30s, without being guided Scrooge-like on a tour of past, present, and future toxic relationships, all the better. This is what my new friends taught me, by example, and I did my best to reciprocate what I was given. I invested in their lives, tried to be helpful, compassionate, a good listener. I opened up, let myself be vulnerable, shared my hopes, anxieties, insecurities, told them I love them. I felt their ups and downs as my own and knew the reverse was true. I realized that I could be loved for who I was, not merely for the amusement I could provide. In truth, I'd been loved for who I was all along. My new friends helped me see that. They helped me to recognize and appreciate the generosity of old friends and family, which I'd been a beneficiary of for so long. This might sound cliched, and it definitely sounds mushy. But in this case, the mushy, cliched things are true. In the abstract, anyway. In practice, love among friends doesn't usually manifest in sentimental ways. We didn't sit in a circle and bare our souls to one another while Nora Jones played in the background. We sat in a half circle and gaped at the increasingly ridiculous twists in the final season of Lost, scream arguing about what it all meant. We got too drunk at Antuanua, danced like idiots, stopped one another from making bad decisions, unless we were really drunk, in which case we encouraged them. We championed one another's projects, lent a hand when asked, attended screenings and gallery shows and concerts. We made absurd videos together and developed a shared sense of humor. We teased, played practical jokes, took it too far, let tiny squabbles escalate into big fights, acted like jerks, forgave one another, laughed about it in retrospect. We met one another's families, visited one another's homes, vacationed in Key West, lived together in Los Angeles, ate 2,000 slices of Domino's pizza in Boston, road tripped from New York City to Portland. A friendship is made up of dozens of big moments and thousands of tiny ones, rides in the back of a cab, late night eats, laughs about stuff no one else finds funny or even understands. If you've been in a tight group of friends, you know how special it can be. The bond between 10 or 5 or 15 people who know one another intimately, who love and like one another, is unlike anything else in the sphere of relationships. There's a sublime sense of unity in a close group of friends, a sense of belonging, of relaxation, of not having to put on an act. At 20, I wasn't sure what kind of act I should be putting on anyway, so it was a gift to have that freedom. For many, college is a time of transition, a time to evaluate the person you've been, the person you created instinctively while growing up, and begin to fashion the person you want to be going forward. I felt very malleable in those years. I don't think it's a coincidence that it's also when I made my deepest friendships. I can't speak for them, but It seemed to me like we were forging our identities together, as well as forging a shared identity. It was through them that I work things out, sometimes explicitly, in conversation or over text, other times implicitly, through laughter and frustration, agreement and disagreement, observation and empathy. Choosing a friend is an act of identity building. You're choosing a complement, and complementary pieces describe each other. As friends grow closer, the interplay of their identities becomes more complex, more reciprocal. Soon, one of the most salient features of Y's self-image is best friend of Z, and vice versa. In a group of close friends, you're the complement of many. Several identities weave into a pattern, a tapestry that is greater than the sum of its individuals. At some point, I began to wonder, is it possible that I am fundamentally entwined with my friends? Why exactly do I insist on thinking of myself as individual and separate? Is it just a trick of the senses, a false assumption rooted in my experience of the body, a cultural norm? I owe so much of my personal development to others. If you magically removed those others, these friends, from my life, who would I be? If I went back in time and took COM 201 when I was supposed to and went to Auckland, who would I be? Not me, not this me, anyway. Some things would be the same, my temperament, my sweet tooth, my hopelessness at sports. But the parts of me I made with my friends, the parts that are my friends, would be gone, and they're essential. I'm used to thinking of individuals as the basic unit of humanity, but maybe it's shared identities that matter most. What does science have to say about this? On the concept of identity, the social sciences have a lot to say, too much for me to adequately cover here. It's a complex subject, but it's also a murky one. Identity means different things to different fields of study: psychology, sociology, politics, etc., even to different scholars in the same field, and the nuances are rarely clarified. This has led some to suggest that we drop the term altogether. What's funny is that we seem to have no issue using identity in casual conversation. It's one of those words we think we understand, but would struggle to explain if pressed. In a handy essay called Identifying Identity, A Semantic History, Philip Gleason tries to clear up some of the ambiguity by tracing the uses of the term through time. Interestingly, you don't have to go that far back to find identity's origins, at least in the sense we think of it today, an individual's self-conception. This connotation emerged and became popular in the 1950s from the work of German-American psychologist Erik Erikson. Before emigrating to the United States on the eve of World War II, Erikson studied with Sigmund Freud's daughter Anna in Vienna, and his work is rooted in psychoanalytic theory, Freud's id-ego-superego model of the psyche. Erikson de-emphasized the sexual dynamics that obsessed Freud, focusing instead on the development of the self through 8 life stages. For Erikson, this process was psychosocial in nature. In each stage, the person confronts a crisis that can be resolved positively or negatively. In the first stage, for example, from birth to 18 months, the disoriented infant looks to the caregiver for stability. The crisis here is between trust and mistrust. If care is consistent and predictable, the baby will gain a sense of trust that carries into future relationships. If needs are not met, the opposite happens. Healthy personalities, argues Erikson, stem from positive resolutions of these crises. Each stage strengthens what Erikson called the ego identity. In stage 4, age 12 to 18, adolescence, the identity becomes self-conscious, and we begin to define for ourselves who we are and what roles we'll assume in our social communities. Friends play a big part in this stage, as they're who we compare and contrast with. As Erickson describes, adolescents help one another temporarily through much discomfort by forming cliques and by stereotyping themselves, their ideals, and their enemies. The crisis of this stage is identity versus role confusion. If adolescents fail to find a stable identity for themselves during this transitional period, they'll feel anxious and unsure, a lack of self-esteem. Erickson coined a familiar term for this, identity crisis. Most of us, I'm sure, have experienced an Ericksonian identity crisis, if not in adolescence, then later in life. It describes what I went through when I failed to meet the requirements for Auckland. Of course, it wasn't really about a study abroad program. New Zealand was just an escape, a way to sustain momentum, so I didn't have to work on myself. Staying back arrested that momentum and forced me to face up to my role confusion. At 20, I was technically in Erickson's fifth stage, characterized by the crisis of intimacy versus isolation. The young adult, he says, emerging from the search for and the insistence on identity, is eager and willing to fuse his identity with that of others. He is ready for intimacy, in other words, the capacity to commit himself to concrete affiliations and partnerships, and to develop the ethical strength to abide by such commitments, even though they may call for significant sacrifices and compromises. There are a lot of problems with psychoanalytic theory, but this strikes me as true to life. In my college friends, I was looking for genuine connections, not mirrors to reflect an image of myself. I was ready to make the compromises that required. Maybe this is what I felt as a shared identity, the fusing of intimacy, Erickson describes. Erickson laid out his stages of psychosocial development in Childhood and Society, published in 1950. In the years that followed, Gleason notes, the cachet of this model grew among intellectuals. As other books followed in quick succession over the next few years, Erickson and his ideas became something of a cultural phenomenon. This is how the sense of identity as we know it entered the cultural drinking water, finding its way into books and classrooms and overpriced self-help seminars. After Erickson opened the door, identity theories proliferated. Some built on his psychosocial model, others reacted against it. In almost all cases, identity is considered to have personal and social aspects, which are fundamental and inseparable. Where scholars differ, and this often depends on whether they're psychologists or sociologists, is on what aspect matters more. Is identity primarily created by the individual mind or primarily socially constructed based on the roles we play, the groups we identify with? There is no definitive answer, and there never will be. The study of identity, like the study of the mind more generally, can't be an exact science. But inexactness isn't uselessness. Most theories of identity contain insights that have sharpened our knowledge of this elusive concept. They've given us a structured language to test against our experiences. That language has helped me understand and articulate the bonds I have with loved ones, how my identity is dependent on theirs, and vice versa. We aren't as discrete as the body implies. Our identities do blend, and the intricacy of that blending in a group of friends is a unity all its own. In day-to-day life, it's far more practical to think of and to refer to ourselves as individuals. After all, that's how society thinks of us. I am responsible for my actions. If my boss gives me a job to do, my group of friends isn't responsible to complete the task as a shared identity. We won't shoulder the blame if the task isn't completed. I will. But if I'm fired, my friends will feel the pain of that firing as their own. If I'm despondent as a result, that gloominess will alter the dynamics of the group until I recover, which they'll help me to do just as antibodies rush in to neutralize pathogens. Most of the time, it's practical to think of ourselves as individuals. But in times of love and times of need, we are never as alone as it sometimes seems. The social sciences are important tools for understanding the links between people. But scholarly language is often excessively complex and made impenetrable with jargon. When I went looking for accurate representations of my experience, I didn't find them in textbooks or academic journals. I found them in fiction. And now I ask, who am I? I have been talking of Bernard, Neville, Ginny, Susan, Rhoda, and Lewis. Am I all of them? Am I one and distinct? I cannot find any obstacle separating us. There is no division between me and them. As I talked, I felt I am you. This difference we make so much of, this identity we so feverishly cherish, was overcome. That's Virginia Woolf from her 1931 novel, The Waves. Of all the evocations of friendship I've read, this is the most powerful. Her prose is the opposite of dry. It's lush, as lyrical as fiction can get without being poetry. Building on techniques she developed in Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse, The Waves tells the story of a group of six friends from childhood to old age through the interior monologues of each person. Only interior monologues. There's no narrator, and we never hear the friends actually talking to one another. Imagine the show Friends, but all you hear are the characters' thoughts, and they're all as eloquent as Virginia Woolf. It's a bizarre, sometimes difficult reading experience, but once you adjust to the rhythm of the text, it absorbs you. At this point in Woolf's career, she was in total command of her craft, and you can feel that control as the prose flowers and dances. Maybe it is poetry. Critics have described the book as a prose poem. Or maybe the distinction doesn't matter. That would fit the theme, as The Waves is obsessed with probing distinctions, namely the distinctions between people. Several times in the book, the friends wonder whether they are distinguishable from one another, or if they make an indistinguishable union. But when we sit together, close, we melt into each other with phrases. We are edged with mist. We make an unsubstantial territory. Bernard. How curiously one is changed by the addition, even at a distance, of a friend. How useful an office one's friends perform when they recall us. Yet how painful to be recalled, to be mitigated, to have one's self adulterated, mixed up, become part of another. Neville. We have tried to accentuate differences. From the desire to be separate, we have laid stress upon our faults and what is particular to us. But there is a chain whirling round, round in a steel blue circle beneath. Lewis. The common fund of experience is very deep. Ginny. The still mood, the disembodied mood, is on us. We enjoy this momentary alleviation. It is not often that one has no anxiety when the walls of the mind become transparent. Rhoda. I am not one person. I am many people. I do not know altogether who I am. Ginny, Susan, Neville, Rhoda, or Lewis, or how to distinguish my life from theirs. Bernard. These are only a few of the reflections the characters have on this subject. Bernard thinks about it the most, almost to the point of obsession, which makes me wonder if I'm the Bernard of my friend group, zealously reading social science theory for corroboration of an eccentric intuition, while the others live their lives in peace, never thinking twice about what sort of sublime unity we form. The others don't dwell on it as much, But even when they're not thinking about the group's interdependence, they betray it in other ways. What then is the knowledge that Ginny has as she dances, the assurance that Susan has as, stooping quietly beneath the lamplight, she draws the white cotton through the eye of her needle? They say yes. They say no. They bring their fists down with a bang on the table. But I doubt. I tremble. The friends are constantly sizing one another up, as Rhoda does with Ginny and Susan here, then measuring themselves against what they see, or think they see. The assessments are often very flawed, which we learn once the POV shifts to the person in question. What seems like assurance is actually disguised anxiety. What seems like a sense of self-reliance is actually a feeling of intense isolation. This, too, strikes me as true to life. The things we see in our friends are not always there. The observations say as much about us as them. But this only contributes to the union of the group. We observe, we project, we react, we reflect, we adjust. Even flawed judgments feed into the mix. Sometimes we become what we think others think we are. Other times we rebel against what we think they think. Either way, we're affected. In healthy friendships, these dynamics are talked through. I tell my friend who I think I am, and she listens. She does the same. She describes what she sees in me, and I listen. I do the same. As a result, we observe and judge each other with nuance and feel comfortable in that mutual patience and tolerance, in that love. Maybe that ideal is never fully achieved. We are too imperfect for that. But the best friendships get pretty close. In the unconventional style of The Waves, we glimpse Wolf's own point of view. Though there is plenty of individuality in the content of each friend's inner monologue, the prose, as critic Carl Woodring says, imposes a single undifferentiated style on the consciousness of all six. The poetic, exuberant language flows from one mind to the next without break. From that river emerges by turns Bernard, Rhoda, Ginny, Neville, Susan, and Lewis, but the emphasis is as much on the river itself as the souls that comprise it. It's not only that I see a true portrait of friendship in this novel, I feel it in Wolf's rhythm. Social science theory can't match this for verisimilitude, which might be unfair because other novelists can't match it either. Maybe it's unnecessary to invoke science and fiction to justify my feelings about friendship. Maybe I ought to trust that my experience has value in itself. I know the individuality we feel is only part of the story. I know this sense of separateness is an accident of biology and culture. I know that I am only part of me, and that the rest is comprised of others, my family, my friends. As John Donne wrote, "No man is an island entire of itself." But there I go, quoting again. It's hard not to when minds like Erickson and Wolf and Donne offer their remarkable powers of articulation to your situation. In a sense, they are part of me too, just as you are, just as this essay, this book, is part of both of us. I write it, but I don't make it. We make it together. It is, to invoke Wolf a final time, the healthy offspring of a close and equal alliance between us. It is a token of the places where we're not separated. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about my friends from college. I met them at a bend in my life, a period when I was unsettled, and together, we created something in which I discovered myself, my shared self. I'm writing this at what I fear is another bend. I'm 33. Almost all of us are married now, a few have children, We've scattered to different cities to pursue careers or be near family or explore the world. For years, people older than I am have warned that this is when friendships begin to fade, as people make families of their own. Always, I brush this off, believing it would not, could not happen to us. We would always be as close as we were in Boston. Now I know we'll probably never be that close again. If you're my age or older, maybe you know what I mean. It's not that we love one another less, it's that there's no substitute for physical proximity and the free time of early adulthood. Priorities shift, responsibilities grow, we make choices. I'm as big a culprit as any. I keep moving to new cities, unable to settle. I see photos of my friends' kids, and they look so old, and I realize how much I've missed. I no longer share in all the biggest developments of their lives. Sending a text, making a call, video chatting, double tapping an Instagram post. It's not the same, is it? Is this how it happens? Not with a bang, but with gaps between hangs that gradually get larger, and you forget to send that birthday message, and you're surprised to learn they actually left that job 6 months ago, and where are you living these days? And the only time you all get together is at weddings, but the weddings are running out, then months turn into years, into decades, and you're telling optimistic 30-somethings that this is when friendships begin to fade. Please do not let me be that guy. I'm not resigning us to that fate, not yet. I'm old enough now to know that it's possible to grow distant from your closest friends. But it's not a foregone conclusion. These people mean too much to me. These people are me. The destabilizing feeling that sinks my stomach at the thought of losing them proves that better than any model of identity, better even than the brilliance of Virginia Woolf. So I'll work to stay in their lives. I'll make an effort to see them. I'll listen and share, ask for advice, tell them I love them. The distance between us makes it harder, but it's only our bodies that are distant. And the body misleads. Write a book. The first day was bad. The second was worse. On the fifth, I began cursing myself out loud. On the sixth, I began doing it in public. Know how you can be so consumed with a line of thinking you forget you're walking down Harrison Street to pick up Tito's burritos? On the sixth day, in the early evening, I was muttering stupid fucking stupid to myself at a crosswalk in Southwest Portland, waving my forefinger in figure eights. 20 minutes later, I said, "Because you're dumb," in an elevator with two people who thankfully did not live on my floor. On the seventh day, the last day of the first week, I gave up. It was the 14th or 15th time I'd done so. Giving up started to feel insincere, which was a welcome development. Not as welcome as writing a single sentence that didn't make me wince and or doubt the value of my entire life, but welcome nonetheless. So I embarked on my second week with hope. It was a bad week. It wasn't until week 5 of writing my novel that I had a good day. By then, I had discovered a few things. That I was a poor writer, and not just a poor writer, but a worthless person, and not just a worthless person, but a despicable one. I discovered these things several times every day, always in that order. My work rang false, I learned, because I had nothing to say. And I had nothing to say because I had little interest in actually writing, only in being a writer. I wanted to be a writer because I was vain, attention-starved, and at the core of me was a black hole where a soul ought to be. Anyway, on my first good day, I wrote 2 not entirely terrible paragraphs. One of them contained this sentence. He began his sojourn to that blistery junction of tri-district gambling not 6 months before, dreaming of a streak, but all he got was a dark new appreciation for settling debts. I don't know what could make a junction blistery, but in December 2010, I thought it sounded perfect for my science fiction novel about an ecumenopolis or planet-wide city. Remembering how harshly I judged myself back then, it's a wonder so many of these lousy sentences made it into the final draft. For every sentence that survived, at least 20 were discarded in a spasm of self-loathing. God knows what horrors lurk in earlier drafts if Blistery Junction made the cut. So much of that book seems dreadful to me now. I was 22, so maybe that's to be expected. But it didn't seem that way on my first good day. After weeks of punching myself in the heart, a morning in which I look back over my work and felt satisfied was deeply relieving. The cruel autobiography playing on loop in my head became a little less persuasive. I slept soundly and woke with optimism, ready to capitalize on this change in momentum, only to fall by lunch into a vortex of even crueler cruelties than before. That was one of those days when you're so filled with disgust that getting out of the house doesn't seem drastic enough, so you spend most of the afternoon looking at flights you'll never take to cities in Europe and Asia. In those early months, I did a lot of research on Zen monasteries in Japan, mentally bracketing the next 5 years for a severe regimen of silence and self-abnegation. The only remedy for my monstrous personality was, obviously, successful transcendence of ego consciousness and a quasi-mystical embodiment of pure incorporeal Buddha nature. In the end, I never went to Japan, but I did have donuts. The bad days after my first good day were just as bad as the ones before it, often much worse, but they were different. The bad days before my first good day were shattering. The ones that came after felt less like a wildfire inside my identity and more like losing a spin on a slot machine that basically never pays out. Both can be demoralizing, but the former is threatening in a way the latter isn't. A good day had occurred, and it wasn't ludicrous to imagine that a good day might occur again. But how many bad days and good donuts would I have to endure until it did? Just 5, it turned out. Days. Midway through my 6th week, I had another good day, on which I wrote this doozy. She dreams of the murder that never happened there, of the finely felt passion darker than coals, that never called out to the silver moon in yearning. What a rose-thorn envy she feels for murderers. What does this even mean? I may have been producing Frankenstein sentences like that, but 22-year-old me approved. Good days gave me confidence to persevere, to push through the sludge of bad ones. Soon, I had one good day a week. I sat at my desk each morning with a cup of coffee, praying it would be the one. More often than not, it wasn't, much more often. But good days kept coming, and eventually, my relationship to bad days permanently changed. Writing a book helped me to recognize the perpetual cycling of mood, to see it as something always in motion. Maybe that's obvious, but writing gave me the chance to observe it in real time. For the most part, I think we try not to pay attention to the mood we're in. If it's a good mood, we're rarely aware of it. Happiness isn't introspective. It points outward to the work or the people or the entertainment at hand. The moment I realize I'm happy is usually when the feeling begins to retreat, like air conditioning programmed to turn on when the house gets too hot. Bad moods, on the other hand, are mercilessly introspective. They plunge inward with great speed to the most fundamental self-criticisms. As a result, I often seek out things to distract myself, like 3 to 11 episodes of Parks and Recreation. Life is a train of moods, like a string of beads, and as we pass through them, they prove to be many-colored lenses which paint the world their own hue, and each shows us only what lies in its focus. That's not from my sci-fi novel, as if there were any doubt. It's Emerson again. I read his essay Experience in college and thought the quote was eloquent, but it wasn't until writing Big City that my own train of moods became visible to me. Knowing something is different from internalizing it. I knew the world was mediated by the many-colored lenses of my moods and temperament, but writing that book forced me to watch my own mind, for better or worse. Usually worse. Try it. Write that novel, that memoir you've been dreaming about. Assign yourself a daily word count, let's say 500 words a day. Grab a coffee, some snacks, and commit to staying put until that goal is reached. Resist distraction. Leave your phone in another room. Now, write. Quiet, isn't it? Too quiet. Better check Twitter. Stop it. Sit in the silence. Stare at the blank page. The white page. Bright white. Can't be good for your eyes to look at that color for long. I think there's a writing app that optimizes the screen for your eyes, and to stop it, try to focus. I know it's hard to focus these days with so much content competing for your attention. Social media companies design their interfaces to be addicting because our attention's their product. It's incredible how much data these companies collect on each of us. Our privacy slips away each time we sign on to Facebook or TikTok. But of course, we don't do anything about it because, for God's sake, get a grip on yourself. Once you push the daydreams from your thoughts, you can usually manage 6 or 7 sentences before the real dark stuff begins to gnaw. There's that famous quote by Ira Glass about beginners. For the first couple years you make stuff, it's just not that good. It's trying to be good. It has potential, but it's not. But your taste, the thing that got you into the game, is still killer, and your taste is why your work disappoints you. I could not agree more. When you start as a writer, your work sucks. And as Glass says, it is only by going through a volume of work that you will close the gap between your writing and your taste. But he leaves out one very important thing. Overcoming your deficiencies as a writer is going to put you in direct conflict with a part of your mind determined to see you fail. In other words, closing the gap between your skill and your taste isn't just a matter of writing a million words, but writing them while battling a relentless antagonist, one who knows your deepest secrets and insecurities. This adversary will use the crap you're producing as a sledgehammer to split the foundations of your self-esteem. It was waiting for some hard evidence. Now you've given the enemy all the documentation it needs to prove you're a dumbass. And it will prove it to you, again and again, every time you sit down to write. When you commit to staying at that desk, you're committing to this psychological fight. Self-hatred derailed me frequently. Many days, I didn't reach my 500 words, choosing instead pizza and YouTube. You can only take so much. But as with anything you do over and over, these internal clashes eventually became routine. I became familiar with the moves my antagonist would make, and though that didn't always stop the blows from landing, it did fortify me. After a while, the predictability of the experience provided a certain detachment, and I was able to witness the negativity from a safe emotional distance, a perspective on a perspective. Good days offered yet another perspective, and the frequency of them increased. Near the end of my second month, I started having 2 good days a week. It felt like an embarrassment of riches. Soon enough, I internalized the reliability of good days. More important, I internalize the reliability of a change in mood, from good to bad and back to good again. The longer I worked, the more good days I had, but the scale never tipped. At best, I had an equal number of good days to bad. Will it ever improve beyond that? Maybe, but I doubt it. To work on something you believe in, I think, is to expose yourself to the spectrum of your mind, to the shadows and the light. As Seinfeld says, it comes as a set. After 6 months, I finished the first draft of Big City. I didn't think it was the next Gatsby or even the next 50 Shades of Grey, but completing a long-form story was incredibly rewarding. A year later, I wrote a second book that was twice as long and, I thought, twice as good. It wasn't. My plan was to self-publish both novels by building an audience on YouTube after seeing the success John Green achieved, thanks in part to his online fan base. I failed to realize two things, however. First, that John was a skilled novelist who had been honing his craft for many years, and I was only at the very, very beginning of that journey. And second, that I would fall in love with the creative medium of online video. After 10 or 15 videos, YouTube stopped being a means to an end and became the craft I wanted to master. A decade of making The Nerdwriter has taught me how much work you really have to do, how many words you really have to write to begin to close that gap between your taste and ability. I still have a long way to go, but I'm proud of the progress I've made. My early books may be crap, but writing them had an immense impact. Learning the dynamics of my mood enabled every success I've had in work and life. When I feel good, I exploit that feeling for all it's worth. When I feel like shit, I batten down the hatches and hold on to my confidence that it will pass. That's so important because it keeps me from changing course during a bad spell, from being tossed in the winds of my attitude. If every bad day resulted in a deconstruction of values and priorities, I'd never make headway on a worthwhile project. A big undertaking, whether it's writing a novel, starting a business, or nurturing a relationship, requires emotional stability. But our emotions aren't stable, so the best we can do is cultivate a bird's-eye view on ourselves to remind us of the colored lens we're seeing through. Eventually, the reflex to that view becomes automatic, and that's especially helpful when I'm at my lowest, about to trash my progress or make a decision I'll regret or succumb to the gloom in my head. With all the poise I can muster, I wait for the clouds to pass. There are more bad hours than bad days, and pick up the thread again. This semblance of stability is good enough. It works. There's nothing more important in creative work than being able to pick up where you left off. Somewhere in my head, there's a graveyard of promising ideas with tombstones that all read, left off on month, day, year, before obsessing about something unproductive for 3 days and forgetting that it ever existed. R.I.P. I've come a long way from that depressing evening on Harrison Street, but not that long, apparently. For some reason, I thought I'd be able to write this short essay with ease. But the 2,475 words you just heard and the 283 to come took the better part of 6 weeks to complete. At least 5 times, I exited my office crestfallen and announced to my wife that I was a poor writer, and not just a poor writer, but a worthless person, and not just a worthless person, but a despicable one. I was frustrated with my inability to make progress while writing an essay about why it's so hard to make progress. I couldn't see the lessons I was literally writing down in front of my face. That's how narrow the tunnel vision of mood can be. But eventually, the fever broke, as it always breaks, as some part of me knows it will. good days came and went. I got to work. I finished it. Acknowledgements. Thanks to my wife, Lisette, who sustained me during the writing of this book. Without her, it wouldn't exist, nor would most of the good things in my life. Thank you to my parents, Nick and Shelley, whom I owe so much. Sorry for all the times I was a brat. Thanks to the Bidney for being the best sister on earth. Thank you to my editor, Stephanie Hitchcock, for giving this book the focus it needed, for your enthusiasm, and for introducing me to the world of publishing with kindness and professionalism. Thanks to my agent, Kirby Kim, who asked me over 2 years ago if I had any interest in writing a book. I did, and then shepherded it through every stage of its creation. Thank you to Danielle Mazzella Di Bosco for the gorgeous cover. Thanks to Sarah Weichel and Ali Catanese for helping Kirby bring this project to life. And thanks to Nate Ruff for always doing what's in my best interest and encouraging me to do the same. Gracias a Barcelona per acudirme mentre escribía aquest libro. Thanks to my local sandwiches, where approximately 37% of this book was written, while listening to Brian Eno and Harold Budd's Ambient 2, The Plateau of Mirror. Thanks to our friends here, who've been overwhelmingly caring. And thank you to all my friends. There's little I can add to the earlier essay, except to say that I think about you every day, and I love you. Finally, thanks to you, the readers, and everyone who's watched The Nerdwriter in the last decade, especially my Patreon patrons. In more ways than one, this book is a product of your incredible support.
Escape into Meaning. Essays on Superman, Public Benches, and Other Obsessions was written and read by Evan Pushak. It was recorded by Santiago Romero Medina and Manuel Orna at Mute Books in Barcelona. Editing and post-production by Fenn Eichner. The associate producer was Joy Asuquo. Escape into Meaning. Essays on Superman, Public Benches, and Other Obsessions was produced and directed by Michael Noble. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Escape into Meaning. Essays on Superman, Public Benches, and Other Obsessions is available in print from Atria Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.